Chapter 10. Shared out amongst our clashing ambitions by the anxious arrangements of statesmen will come to an end, before we attain the felicity of greeting with unanimous applause the perfect fruition of a great state. It is even possible that we are destined for another sort of bliss altogether. That sort which consists in being perpetually duped by false appearances. But whatever political illusion the future may hold out to our fear or admiration, there will be none, it is safe to say, which in the magnitude of anti-humanitarian effect will equal that phantom now driven out of the world by the thunder of thousands of guns. None that in its retreat will cling with an equally shameless sincerity to more unworthy supports. To the moral corruption and mental darkness of slavery, to the mere brute force of numbers. This very ignominy of infatuation should make clear to men's feelings and reason that the downfall of Russia's might is unavoidable. Spectral it lived, and spectral it disappears without leaving a memory of a single generous deed, of a single service rendered even involuntarily to the polity of nations. Other despotisms there have been, but none whose origin was so grimly fantastic in its baseness, and the beginning of whose end was so gruesomely ignoble. What is amazing is the myth of its irresistible strength which is dying so hard. Considered historically, Russia's influence in Europe seems the most baseless thing in the world, a sort of convention invented by diplomatists for some dark purpose of their own, one would suspect, if the lack of grasp upon the realities of any given situation were not the main characteristic of the management of international relations. A glance back at the last 100 years shows the invariable, one may say the logical, powerlessness of Russia. As a military power it has never achieved by itself a single great thing. It has been indeed able to repel an ill-considered invasion, but only by having recourse to the extreme methods of desperation. In its attacks upon its specially selected victim this giant always struck, as if with a withered right hand. All the campaigns against Turkey prove this, from Potemkin's time to the last Eastern War in 1878 entered upon with every advantage of a well-nursed prestige and a carefully fostered fanaticism. Even the half-armed were always too much for the might of Russia, or, rather, of the Tsardom. It was victorious only against the practically disarmed, as, in regard to its ideal of territorial expansion, a glance at a map will prove sufficiently. As an ally, Russia has been always unprofitable, taking her share in the defeats, rather than in the victories of her friends, but always pushing her own claims with the arrogance of an arbiter of military success. As he has been unable to help to any purpose a single principle to hold its own, not even the principle of authority and legitimism which Nicholas I had declared so haughtily, to rest under his special protection. Just as Nicholas II has tried to make the maintenance of peace on earth his own exclusive affair. And the first Nicholas was a good Russian. He held the belief in the sacredness of his realm with such an intensity of faith, that he could not survive the first shock of doubt. Rightly envisaged, the Crimean War was the end of what remained of absolutism and legitimism in Europe. It threw the way open for the liberation of Italy. The war in Manchuria makes an end of absolutism in Russia, whoever has got to perish from the shock behind a rampart of dead ukases, manifestos, and rescripts. In the space of 50 years the self-appointed apostle of absolutism, and the self-appointed apostle of peace, the Augustus and the Augustulus of the regime, that was wont to speak contemptuously to European foreign offices in the beautiful French phrases of Prince Gorchakov, have fallen victims, each after his kind, to their shadowy and dreadful familiar, to the phantom, part ghoul, part djinn, part old man of the sea, with beak and claws and a double head, looking greedily both east and west on the confines of two continents. That nobody through all that time penetrated the true nature of the monster it is impossible to believe. But of the many who must have seen, all were either too modest, too cautious, perhaps too discreet, to speak, or else were too insignificant to be heard or believed. Yet not all. In the very early 60s, Prince Bismarck, then about to leave his post of Prussian minister in St. Petersburg, called, so the story goes, upon another distinguished diplomatist. After some talk upon the general situation, the future chancellor of the German Empire remarked that it was his practice to resume the impressions he had carried out of every country where he had made a long stay in a short sentence, which he caused to be engraved upon some trinket. "I am leaving this country now, and this is what I bring away from it," he continued, taking off his finger a new ring to show to his colleague the inscription inside. "Arussi, Kestlenit." Prince Bismarck had the truth of the matter, and was neither too modest nor too discreet to speak out. Certainly he was not afraid of not being believed. Yet he did not shout his knowledge from the housetops. He meant to have the Phantom as his accomplice in an enterprise which has set the clock of peace back for many a year. He had his way. The German Empire has been an accomplished fact for more than a third of a century, a great and dreadful legacy left to the world by the ill-omened Phantom of Russia's might. It is that Phantom which is disappearing now unexpectedly, astonishingly, as if by a touch of that wonderful magic for which the East has always been famous. The pretense of belief in its existence will no longer answer anybody's purposes now Prince Bismarck is dead, unless the purposes of the writers of sensational paragraphs, as to this need making an armed descent upon the plains of India. That sort of folly would be beneath notice if it did not distract attention from the real problem created for Europe by a war in the Far East. For good or evil in the working out of her destiny, Russia is bound to remain a need for many long years, in a more even than a Bismarckian sense. The very fear of this specter being gone, it behoves us to consider its legacy the fact, no phantom that, accomplished in Central Europe by its help and connivance. The German Empire may feel at bottom the loss of an old accomplice always amenable to the confidential whispers of a bargain, but in the first instance it cannot but rejoice at the fundamental weakening of a possible obstacle to its instincts of territorial expansion. There is a removal of that latent feeling of restraint which the presence of a powerful neighbor, however implicated with you in a sense of common guilt, is bound to inspire. The common guilt of the two empires is defined precisely by their frontier line running through the Polish provinces. Without indulging in excessive feelings of indignation at that country's partition, or going so far as to believe with a late French politician in the imminent justice they chose, it is clear that a material situation, based upon an essentially immoral transaction, contains the germ of fatal differences in the temperament of the two partners in iniquity, whatever the iniquity is. Germany has been the evil counselor of Russia on all the questions of her Polish problem, always urging the adoption of the most repressive measures with a perfectly logical duplicity. Prince Bismarck's empire has taken care to couple the neighborly offers of military assistance with merciless advice. The thought of the Polish provinces accepting a frank reconciliation with a humanized Russia and bringing the weight of homogeneous loyalty within a few miles of Berlin has been always intensely distasteful to the arrogant Germanizing tendencies of the other partner in iniquity. And, besides, the way to the Baltic provinces leads over the Niemen and over the Vistula. And now, when there is a possibility of serious internal disturbances destroying the sort of order autocracy has kept in Russia, the road over these rivers is seen wearing a more inviting aspect. At any moment the pretext of armed intervention may be found in a revolutionary outbreak provoked by socialists, perhaps, but at any rate by the political immaturity of the enlightened classes and by the political barbarism of the Russian people. The throes of Russian resurrection will be long and painful. This is not the place to speculate upon the nature of these convulsions, but there must be some violent breakup of the lamentable tradition, a shattering of the social, of the administrative, certainly of the territorial unity. Voices have been heard saying that the time for reforms in Russia is already past. This is the superficial view of the more profound truth, that for Russia there has never been such a time within the memory of mankind. It is impossible to initiate a rational scheme of reform upon a phase of blind absolutism. And in Russia there has never been anything else to which the faintest tradition could, after ages of error, go back as to a parting of ways. In Europe the old monarchical principle stands justified in its historical struggle with the growth of political liberty by the evolution of the idea of nationality as we see it concreted at the present time. By the inception of that wider solidarity grouping together around the standard of monarchical power these larger agglomerations of mankind. This service of unification, creating close-knit communities possessing the ability, the will, and the power to pursue a common ideal, has prepared the ground for the advent of a still larger understanding. For the solidarity of Europeanism, which must be the next step towards the advent of concord and justice, an advent that, however delayed by the fatal worship of force, and the errors of national selfishness, has been, and remains, the only possible goal of our progress. The conceptions of legality, of larger patriotism, of national duties and aspirations have grown under the shadow of the old monarchies of Europe, which were the creations of historical necessity. There were seeds of wisdom in their very mistakes and abuses. They had a past and a future. They were human. But under the shadow of Russian autocracy nothing could grow. Russian autocracy succeeded to nothing. It had no historical past, and it cannot hope for a historical future. It can only end. By no industry of investigation, by no fantastic stretch of benevolence, can it be presented as a phase of development through which a society, a state, must pass on the way to the full consciousness of its destiny. It lies outside the stream of progress. This despotism has been utterly un-European. Neither has it been Asiatic in its nature. Oriental despotisms belong to the history of mankind. They have left their trace on our minds and our imagination by their splendor, by their culture, by their art, by the exploits of great conquerors. The record of their rise and decay has an intellectual value. They are in their origins and their course the manifestations of human needs, the instruments of racial temperament, of catastrophic force, of faith and fanaticism. The Russian autocracy as we see it now is a thing apart. It is impossible to assign to it any rational origin in the vices, the misfortunes, the necessities, or the aspirations of mankind. That despotism has neither an European nor an Oriental parentage. More, it seems to have no root either in the institutions, or the follies of this earth. What strikes one with a sort of awe is just this something inhuman in its character. It is like a visitation, like a curse from heaven falling in the darkness of ages upon the immense plains of forest and steppe lying dumbly on the confines of two continents. A true desert harboring no spirit either of the East, or of the West. This pitiful fate of a country held by an evil spell, suffering from an awful visitation for which the responsibility cannot be traced either to her sins or her follies, has made Russia as a nation so difficult to understand by Europe. From the very first ghastly dawn of her existence as a state as she had to breathe the atmosphere of despotism. She found nothing but the arbitrary will of an obscure autocrat at the beginning and end of her organization. Hence arises her impenetrability to whatever is true in Western thought. Western thought, when it crosses her frontier, falls under the spell of her autocracy, and becomes a noxious parody of itself. Hence the contradictions, the riddles of her national life, which are looked upon with such curiosity by the rest of the world. The curse had entered her very soul. Autocracy, and nothing else in the world, has molded her institutions, and with the poison of slavery drugged the national temperament into the apathy of a hopeless fatalism. It seems to have gone into the blood, tainting every mental activity in its source by a half-mystical, insensate, fascinating assertion of purity and holiness. The government of Holy Russia, arrogating to itself the supreme power to torment and slaughter the bodies of its subjects like a God-sent scourge, has been most cruel to those whom it allowed to live under the shadow of its dispensation. The worst crime against humanity of that system we behold now crouching at bay behind vast heaps of mangled corpses is the ruthless destruction of innumerable minds. The greatest horror of the world madness walked faithfully in its train. Some of the best intellects of Russia, after struggling in vain against the spell, ended by throwing themselves at the feet of that hopeless despotism as a giddy man leaps into an abyss. An attentive survey of Russia's literature, of her church, of her administration and the cross-currents of her thought, must end in the verdict that the Russia of today has not the right to give her voice on a single question touching the future of humanity, because from the very inception of her being the brutal destruction of dignity, of truth, of rectitude, of all that is faithful in human nature has been made the imperative condition of her existence. The great governmental secret of that imperium which Prince Bismarck had the insight and the courage to call Lenin has been the extirpation of every intellectual hope. To pronounce in the face of such a past the word evolution, which is precisely the expression of the highest intellectual hope, is a gruesome pleasantry. There can be no evolution out of a grave. Another word of less scientific sound has been very much pronounced of late in connection with Russia's future, a word of more vague import, a word of dread as much as of hope: revolution. In the face of the events of the last 4 months, this word has sprung instinctively, as it were, on grave lips, and has been heard with solemn forebodings. More or less consciously, Europe is preparing herself for a spectacle of much violence, and perhaps of an inspiring nobility of greatness. And there will be nothing of what she expects. She will see neither the anticipated character of the violence, nor yet any signs of generous greatness. Her expectations, more or less vaguely expressed, give the measure of her ignorance of that need which for so many years had remained hidden behind this phantom of invincible armies. Need? In a way, yes. And yet perhaps Prince Bismarck has let himself be led away by the seduction of a good phrase into the use of an inexact form. The form of his judgment had to be pithy, striking, engraved within a ring. If he erred, then, no doubt, he erred deliberately. The saying was near enough the truth to serve, and perhaps he did not want to destroy utterly by a more severe definition the prestige of the sham that could not deceive his genius. Prince Bismarck has been really complimentary to the useful phantom of the autocratic might. There is an awe-inspiring idea of infinity conveyed in the word need, and in Russia there is no idea. She is not a need, she is and has been simply the negation of everything worth living for. She is not an empty void, she is a yawning chasm open between east and west, a bottomless abyss that has swallowed up every hope of mercy, every aspiration towards personal dignity, towards freedom, towards knowledge, every ennobling desire of the heart, every redeeming whisper of conscience. Those that have peered into that abyss, where the dreams of Panslavism, of universal conquest, mingled with the hate and contempt for Western ideas, drift impotently like shapes of mist, know well that it is bottomless, that there is in it no ground for anything that could in the remotest degree serve even the lowest interests of mankind, and certainly no ground ready for a revolution. The sin of the old European monarchies was not the absolutism inherent in every form of government. It was the inability to alter the forms of their legality, grown narrow and oppressive with the march of time. Every form of legality is bound to degenerate into oppression, and the legality in the forms of monarchical institutions sooner, perhaps, than any other. It has not been the business of monarchies to be adaptive from within. with the mission of uniting and consolidating the particular ambitions and interests of feudalism in favor of a larger conception of a state, of giving self-consciousness, force and nationality to the scattered energies of thought and action, they were fated to lag behind the march of ideas they had themselves set in motion in a direction they could neither understand nor approve. Yet, for all that, the thrones still remain, and what is more significant, perhaps, some of the dynasties too, have survived. The revolutions of European states have never been in the nature of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.